This is a Crowd podcast.
We Didn't Start the Fire, the only podcast started by me, Billy Joel.
Birth control.
Ho Chi Minh.
Uncle Ho.
Ho, ho, ho.
Hello again, and welcome to episode 98 of We Didn't Start the Fire, the history podcast based on Billy Joel's pop opus that set the syllabus to school us on the headlines, heroes, and villains of the late 20th century. I'm Katie Puckrick.
I'm Tom Fordyce.
Tom, I'm kind of wondering how we got to where we are today, because Billy thinks it might have something to do with Ho Chi Minh. Now, Ho Chi Minh, another Cold War cutie. The Vietnamese revolutionary and leader who, through dogged determination and unremitting craftiness, kept both the French and the Americans from taking over Vietnam.
Katie, he's one of the seismic figures of 20th century history. Slightly strangely, I've been to his mausoleum because in Hanoi, there is still the pickled preserved shape of a very small Ho Chi Minh. You can go and see him.
Is he as delicious as a pickle?
I didn't lick his feet. I don't know.
Okay.
What is your connection or your experience or your prior knowledge of Ho Chi Minh?
Zero. Nothing. These are the kind of episodes I relish when we're doing this podcast because I get to learn and I get to kind of connect the dots because it turns out in my little pre-research that there's quite a few moments of intersection with a lot of other We Didn't Start the Fire topics. And also, he's one of those fellows. There's a few of them in this song. Billy likes to kind of throw us a few curveballs. People who were born in the 1800s, I'm thinking of whether it's Mao Zedong or Charles de Gaulle, Zhou Enlai. So by the time they show up in We Didn't Start the Fire, the bulk of their life has already been lived and their youthful picaresque adventures have already happened. So they're very front-loaded characters. And Ho Chi Minh's one of those front-loaded characters.
Yeah, so we think he's in this song at this point, Katie, because in 1969 he dies. He's 79 years old. Slightly embarrassingly, I actually thought he survived till the end of the Vietnam War sometime later. But Katie,
yeah,
we have someone with us who can put us right on all our wrongs.
Good.
Our guest today is Olga Draw, Professor of History at Texas A&M University and Fellow of Collegium de Lyon in France. Welcome to We Didn't Start the Fire, Olga.
Hello. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, Olga, we want to learn all about Ho Chi Minh, but before we dive right back into the start of his life, just give us a very brief summary of why he is such a huge figure in 20th century history.
Wow, he's known for many, many accomplishments, but perhaps why he became so well known in the first place, he was the first president of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam when it was established in 1945. He proclaimed independent Vietnam that until that time was colonized by France and later during World War II by Japan. Ho Chi Minh led the organization called Viet Minh, the union, the coalition of different forces, communist and non-communist, but anti-colonialist, that fought for independence of their country.
Yeah. So Ho Chi Minh is one of those stalwart characters in history whose whole gig seems to be to midwife a nation. He just has a conviction from the very beginning that the Vietnamese need to kick out all the colonizers and take over the reins. Where does this conviction first emerge? What are the early signs?
Well, it depends on what materials you rely. Vietnamese materials, Communist Party materials, the party line is that he was raised in a family that had strong anti-colonial inclinations and that he was raised in this spirit. We don't know why exactly he left Vietnam, which he left in 1911. When he travels the world, he becomes more convinced that he needed to fight to make his country independent. And it was very important for him. he becomes one of the founding members of the French Communist Party in hopes that the French would help him. The Communist Party was not interested in this, so he left for the Soviet Union.
He isn't a revolutionary, Olga, who is all about the theories. This is a man who gets his hands dirty, who does the sort of jobs that a lot of revolutionaries don't. And some of these jobs are, Katie, we found this quite charming, didn't we, in our research. The fact that he works in the kitchen on a French merchant steamer, that's how he leaves Vietnam. He lives in New York, he lives in West Ealing in London, he lives in Crouch End in North London. At one point, he is the pastry chef on the New Haven to Dieppe ferry.
I like this. This is what I was going to get into with you, Olga, was, you know, you always get the CV, the resume, at the end of a person's accomplished life, where you just accept that they're some kind of action adventurer. But it's interesting to see, like, oh, these are the nuts and bolts of how you get yourself the heck out of Dodge and around the world. Because can you give us a sense of what he looked like? He was a very small man, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
Like 4'11" or something, I read?
No, I think he was over 5 feet tall.
Okay, we'll give him that. Probably his enemies were trying to diminish him. But but I guess what I'm thinking is, I have this idea, you see these pictures of him as an elderly man with a wispy beard, and he's, you know, he's pretty desiccated. And you think, like, how does somebody, okay, he was a young man, he had that vim and vigor. He must have had so much gumption and grit to propel himself into this strange world and to learn all these languages.
Absolutely. And it's very interesting. First of all, if we talk about how tall he was, it depends at what period of time we're talking about.
Okay.
Because as we all, he shrank, right?
That's true.
We all
not
do,
me, I'm not going to shrink.
He had incredible charisma, incredible will. A lot of this is actually a myth that he helped to create. We don't know that he ever was in the United States. No documents were found about it. There was a special team who worked 20 years ago who tried to find traces of his appearance in the United States, but there is no confirmation about it.
So he's excellent at making myths, but it does sound like he definitely was in Moscow. What was he getting up to there? Because that was quite formative.
Yes, this story relies on his biography that was written by himself under a different name.
Uh-huh.
He describes his travels, how modest he was, and it was not supposed to be known that it was him, because the book starts that President Ho Chi Minh, he's very, very modest and he doesn't want to bother people with his details of his life, and so he writes this book. And he is really the most enigmatic leader perhaps in the world, in a sense there are huge periods of time that we don't know much about. But it is evident at the beginning of the 1920s, he is in France and he is disillusioned that the French, even the French communists, they didn't want to help to liberate Vietnam. So he thinks that he has to go to the Soviet Union in hopes that the Soviets would help him. And he becomes the agent of Comintern, of Communist International, the organization that united communists from different parts of the world under the leadership of the Soviet Union.
He seems, Casey, sometimes, Ho Chi Minh, like a Vietnamese Forrest Gump, in that he appears at all these major points in history, one of them being the Treaty of Versailles all the way back in 1919, when he takes this concept that's being used as part of the settlement, the idea of self-determination, and thinks to himself, well, this will work for Vietnam. And he's slightly horrified when it doesn't seem to work if you're not European.
Right.
The other little detail I love from this time, Katie, and you'll understand why when I explain this story. Apparently he worked for a French magazine in about 1922, and he had this idea that he wanted French sports writers to no longer use English terms when they were describing French things. So there was a, you would talk about le manager, or you would talk about le round or le knockout. So I love this idea that he's that bothered about these things that he's actually going to sports writers, my old job,
yes,
and say, no, come up with your own language. So I thought, well, hang on, did it actually work? Are French managers still called Le Manager? Well, I don't think they are. Now, Olga, you speak French, I know, so you might be able to help me out here. But I think that someone like Didier Deschamps, who is the current manager of the French national team, I think he's known as the entraîneur rather than the manager. So maybe Ho Chi Minh, Katie. He's had effects in ways we know and effects in ways we never even guessed.
The butterfly effect. So he's the ultimate busker, it seems. He's sort of a political busker. It's just absolutely boggling how Ho Chi Minh keeps bouncing around from country to country, learning, teaching, politicking. Maybe he's getting into a little bit of spying. He gets imprisoned at one stage. Tell us about that.
Yes. So he was imprisoned more than once. And the French actually convicted him in absentia because he leaves Vietnam in 1911. He doesn't come back until 30 years later. So for 30 years, he's all over the world, anywhere but in Vietnam. The beginning of the 1930s, he's in Hong Kong and he is sentenced by the French in absentia. And the Hong Kong authorities arrest him. The French ask to extradite him to Indochina, which was their colony. The Brits, whose colony Hong Kong was at the time, they agree to this. Suddenly, something happens. A British lawyer appears and he argues his case and manages to reverse the decision, and he is not extradited. And he gets back to the Soviet Union. The official story is that it was the communist who helped him. But when he gets to the Soviet Union, the Soviets ask him, how the hell you got out of the prison? It's not like they knew. And he refuses to answer. The Soviets suspected that he was a double agent.
Right.
He refuses to answer. And basically, for several years, he is in the Soviet Union. He is not imprisoned, but he is not allowed to do anything of political significance. There was a committee organized to judge what he had done there, because it was not only how he got out of the prison, but there was a cell, a Vietnamese communist Chinese cell that was busted and he was suspected. Well, this committee decided that he was kind of responsible, but it's not that it was his intention. It's just because he was inexperienced. What we know that he lived in the Soviet Union through the most difficult time, the purges, Stalin purges.
Yeah.
He never ever discussed or denounced anything.
Because the story goes that after World War II, he'd sent several letters to Truman begging for assistance to get the French out. And the letters went unanswered. And that's why he turned, perhaps this is simplistic, but that's why he turned to the USSR and China for help. But it seems that it could have gone either way. Like if the U.S. said, sure, we'll assist you as an emerging nation, he could have just like put the communism on hold, on the back burner, and just said he was a nationalist.
Well, it's always very interesting to consider this idea, but it was not, geopolitical situation in the world was not such that the United States could entertain this idea, because the United States was not interested in Vietnam or in the China at all. Mm. What the United States was interested in was France. The communist movement there was very strong, and the French were blackmailing Americans. You either help us or we might go communist.
That's the threat that always works, isn't it, with America?
Why were medieval priests so worried that women were going to seduce men with fish that they'd kept in their pants? Who was the first gay activist? And what on earth does the expression sneezing in the cabbage mean? I'll tell you, it's not a cookery technique, that's for sure. Join me, Kate Lister, on Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex scandal in society, a podcast where we will be bedhopping throughout time and civilization to bring you the quirkiest and kinkiest stories from history. What more could you possibly want? Listen to Betwixt the Sheets today, wherever it is that you get your podcasts, a podcast by History Hit.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp Therapy Online. I've got a question for you. How is your social battery feeling right now? Because it can be easy to ignore how we're feeling and sometimes spread ourselves too thin. You know what it's like. Social gatherings are starting to pick up pace after the long drag of winter. But what's the right amount of socializing for you and how do you recharge? Well, therapy can help give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. So if you're thinking of exploring these areas and starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/WDSTF, for We Didn't Start the Fire. That's betterhelp.com/WDSTF. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Always fresh and never frozen, each meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. I eat flexitarian, so with a weekly menu of 35 options, there's plenty for me to choose from. So last night, I had the Moroccan-style almond-crusted salmon. It was absolutely delicious. These are no-fuss, no-mess meals. Factor eliminates the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savour the good stuff. With over 60 add-ons like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and smoothies, there's plenty of options to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. Plus, you can customise your weekly meals and pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. What are you waiting for? Head to factormeals.com/WDSTF50 and use the code WDSTF50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code WDSTF50 at factormeals.com/WDSTF50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Talk to us about his new identity, a little bit like Madonna keeps changing his look, changing his style, genre of music. So he's changed his name to Ho Chi Minh. What's the big idea there and what does it actually mean?
Ho Huyen Lights. Ho is another family name. Not family name, it's a clan name because there are no family names in Vietnam in general. For him, I think it was a break from what he was abroad, and now he was closer to his country. There are also different rumors that Ho Chi Minh, who came to Vietnam, was not Ho Chi Minh, who left Vietnam in 1911.
Oh, a whole different person.
A whole different person. Oh. But I don't think so, because
that's messy.
We have pictures from Sûreté, the police in France, the security service, and he had very distinctive ears. It can be seen that it's the same ears. He comes to Vietnam. He enters the territory of Vietnam as Ho Chi Minh, as the person bringing the light. And when people ask him, are you, and when I quote, the same person, he doesn't want ever to give any details. He wants to keep the mystery. Mm. Mystery is his thing.
He's even mysterious about his activity with the ladies, because as he moves around the world, he has different companions. And yet, at one point in my research, I came across some detail that he was insisting that he was celibate because didn't have any time for that sort of roistering. He had his masculine essence was focused on the project of Vietnam.
We do know that he was married a couple of times. Apparently, he had some illegitimate kids, but his idea was that I'm the head, actually, of my nation. The nation is my family. And it is forbidden to still talk about Ho Chi Minh's women in Vietnam.
Oh.
And for example, Bill Dyker, he wrote a biography of Ho Chi Minh that Vietnamese liked quite a lot, but they said that they would need to remove his mentioning of women. And he said no. And so the book is stuck.
Why is that a problem? He's not allowed to be a human being? Are they trying to turn him into a deity of some sort?
He tried to turn himself to this modest deity. It's very strange because those other presidents who were revolutionary, Mao didn't make any secret that he had wives, not to mention all his love for young girls. But Stalin had wives, Sukarno, everyone.
Olga, there's a phrase that has popped up in the research that Katie and I have done that's left us slightly puzzled, and that is the kissing president. Can you explain more?
Yes, he showed incredible warmth when he would meet other people. And it should be noted that in Asia in general, people don't kiss left and right. It was taken from the Soviet Union because the Soviet leaders, they loved to kiss. And there are some very interesting picture of Brezhnev kissing with Honecker, the leader of the German Democratic Republic. But Ho Chi Minh took it into a completely different point because we see some scenes, him meeting Mao, and he's trying to kiss Mao all over, and Mao is trying to escape from him. He was always very warm to children. He would give them candies, and they would he would kiss them. Well, he comes to Indonesia for an official visit, and he kisses a lot of children there, including girls. People there did not take kindly to it. They thought that it was not really something appropriate. Unlike Mao, who loved young girls to sleep with, Ho Chi Minh, I don't think he had any inclinations like that, even though apparently his last love interest was a young person, but she was not a child in any way.
Katie, shall we get into what feels like the meat that Billy has served us up here, which is the what we could call the Second Indochina War or the Vietnam War if you're American.
Or if you're Vietnamese.
The American War.
The American War.
So, Olga, is that war, whichever term we choose to define it by, is that inevitable as soon as those Geneva Accords have happened? Is there something in Ho Chi Minh which isn't ever going to settle for two Vietnams, for a North Vietnam and a South Vietnam, that in his mind he wants to reunify the nation?
He never made a secret that he would like two Vietnams to be united, but under socialist or communist regime, under his regime. After Geneva, the Geneva Accord, when Vietnam was divided into two parts, Ho Chi Minh actually initially favored to build a strong North Vietnam and then to get to South Vietnam. At the end of 1959, beginning 1960, Ho Chi Minh actually loses his power. He becomes more a symbol. And it is two people from the South who are more belligerent and they want to unify Vietnam now. It doesn't seem that Ho Chi Minh was in favor of this, but he was definitely supporting it as soon as it came really to the war, even if he was not behind this. For Americans, it was the Vietnam War because it was a country where the war took place. But American War, we have to be very cautious when we use this term because it was the term that was used by the communists. We completely eliminate the people in South Vietnam who didn't want to live under communism. As much as it was part of the Cold War, it was a civil war.
That's an interesting perspective. I hadn't ever considered that as well, that there was conflicts within Vietnam about the direction of the war.
Olga, what is it about Ho Chi Minh that makes him so iconic amongst those protesting against the war in the West?
This person who is so small physically, with his beard, with his kissing, with all the difficulties in Vietnam, he was no Stalin and no Mao. He didn't kill those millions and millions of people. Nevertheless, he was creating an autocratic state. But it was the state that withstand imperialism. We don't discuss that it was democracy that brought the United States out of Vietnam. And in many ways in France too, it was because people went out to the streets. And the Vietnamese, from the very beginning of the war, the communists, they were very smart. They had a very clear idea that militarily we cannot win this conflict, but we will win it in the streets of the United States. And this is what happened.
That's very clever. That's a very interesting rephrasing. Now, I read that Richard Nixon sent a letter to Ho Chi Minh in 1969 asking for a stop to the fighting. Maybe he misplayed it because he peppered the letter with threats, and Ho Chi Minh's response is basically, thanks for the letter. like no response, in other words. Diplomacy wasn't really getting anywhere with regard to America's desire to end the war?
Well, diplomacy did eventually get Americans out of the war. With Nixon's letter, I think it was written on July 15th, 1969.
Yeah, it was in the summer.
I told you that starting from 1960, Ho Chi Minh was kind of sidelined politically. In July, he could not write this letter.
Oh, okay. So he would have been ailing by that time, by mid-July.
He was ailing, and what they present as his letter, it's a thing that is typed. Usually, if they want to prove that it's original, it would be written by hand. This is beyond the point, because the Vietnamese at that point, they didn't want. They had this Tet Offensive 1968, which was militarily completely disastrous for communists, but a great political success. And people in the United States, they came out in the streets. So Vietnamese were politically in a pretty good position, but I had very strong doubts that Ho Chi Minh himself, because the letter is quite long. I mean, it's a couple of pages. He was in very bad shape by that time.
How does the nation react when he dies?
North Vietnam is in deep mourning. People feel like they lost a great figure, and this is what Ho Chi Minh himself and his entourage were building, this uncle figure. Moreover, in South Vietnam, when I talk about South Vietnam, there were communist forces, and they mourn Ho Chi Minh deeply. And a lot of foreign dignitaries come. But as you perhaps know, he died not on the day when it was announced, because he died September 2nd. This is their Independence Day. So they didn't want to sour the mood of celebration. They announced it a day later. And it was only in, I think, 1989 that they decided to announce his real date of death.
So what happened, Olga, after he died in terms of his death having an effect on the progress of the war?
There were very difficult negotiations in 1972. Americans were trying to negotiate some better conditions for South Vietnam. And Vietnamese just left negotiations. And then when happened the Christmas bomb in 1972, when Americans bombed really mercilessly after not bombing for quite a long time, and it made Vietnamese to come back to the table. They signed an agreement of which South Vietnamese, who were not communists, were very unhappy, because they basically abandoned South Vietnamese. Americans would leave in 1973, and for 2 years, South Vietnam fought against communists by itself. And when Americans leave, the Soviet Union and China, they still support North Vietnam, and South Vietnam stands alone. So April 30th, 1975, it's the fall of Saigon.
I love this line, Olga, from an Australian journalist during the fall of Saigon. So this is April 1975, so it's pretty much 5.5, 6 years since the death of Ho Chi Minh. And this journalist talks about the references to Ho Chi Minh on the tanks from the soldiers and says, when the North Vietnamese marched into Saigon, they were led by a man who wasn't there. Which gives you that indication of the power that he still had all those years later.
Yes, absolutely. Because he was building himself as a symbol, his entourage built, and they were very, very successful. You mentioned seeing him in the mausoleum. This is what the party wanted. Ho Chi Minh didn't want to be put into the mausoleum. This was the party violating his wishes that put him there because they needed him as a unifying and mobilizing force. And they still evoke him very often. It becomes more and more difficult because each generation he is farther and farther away.
What's the current political system now in the unified Vietnam?
Until mid-1980s, so for 10 years, Vietnam was in a terrible economic situation, terrible. The inflation was like 400% a year. A lot of people started to question whether it was worth fighting first French, then Americans to get this. When the Soviet Union started its perestroika, Vietnamese also started their renovation period. And now it's a very interesting system. They proclaim still that they are a socialist country building communism. There is no any free speech in Vietnam. So there is this problem. But the economy is capitalist, is practically capitalist.
Olga, Ho Chi Minh was absolutely such a resolute leader. He didn't seem to be motivated by power or greed or great clothes or money. But there must have been something that drove him. I mean, obviously the man had an ego, but he was definitely playing the long game. How do you think that he stacks up against other leaders that surrounded him at the time? Your Stalins, your Mao's, your Charles de Gaulle. How do you think he stacks up on the world leader sweepstakes?
I think he's an extraordinary person, really extraordinary person. He was motivated by a love for his country and to achieve this by the methods that he saw fit.
Olga Jor, thank you so much for coming on We Didn't Start the Fire. Thank you for filling the heads of Katie and me and all our listeners with so much knowledge about Ho Chi Minh.
Thank you so much, and I hope to hear and see you soon.
I gotta hand it to Uncle Ho. He's in it for the long game, and he's just dodie-doing his way through every happening country in the world, making some pastries on the side.
Yeah, and he stuck it out, and in the end, he got what he wanted, Katie,
he got what he wanted.
The longest of long games.
The longest of long games, and sort of slyly ghost wrote his own biography in a very favorable fashion, akin somewhat to writing your own Wikipedia entry.
That's the equivalent, the 20th century equivalent.
Yes.
I like the fact that he went for the uncle moniker, because we often hear about revolutionary leaders being the father of the nation,
yeah,
which is fine, but fathers can be quite strict, can't they? Well, uncles tend to be more fun. They tend to be more avuncular.
Yeah.
Because, yes, they have a sort of disciplinary role, but not to the extent that a father does. So I think people can feel sort of very fond about uncles.
Yeah.
So I think that was quite a clever thing he did there. You know, I'm not really your boss. I'm sort of a friendly boss.
Yeah, I might cast a stern look in your direction if you're getting
kiss.
Out of hand. Oh, yeah. Or a handsy kiss, one or the other.
If you would like another podcast to listen to, why not go back and listen to our other episodes about Vietnam? Dien Bien Phu with historian and host of the History Hit podcast, Dan Snow. That's a really, really good one.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Make sure you check it out if you haven't already.
And if you'd like to get in touch with a story or a guest idea, we are all ears. You can contact us on email at fire@crowdnetwork.co.uk or on social media. We are at Spread That Fire on Instagram and Twitter. And make sure you check out our merch collection at spreadthatfire.com.
Katie, next week we have someone coming back back who has already appeared and will then appear for a third time. He is someone you referenced who wrote a very long letter to Ho Chi Minh. It is Tricky Dicky.
Tricky Dicky. Richard Nixon back again. I can't wait. Can't get enough of that funky stuff.
Crowd Network.
A place where you belong.
Welcome to Anthology of Heroes, the podcast that explores the most pivotal moments of history through the eyes of those who lived it. In this podcast, we don't spend our time recounting facts and dates. Instead, we follow in the footsteps of national heroes, kings, or ordinary people who lived and breathed the moments that shaped our world. We're not hemmed in by eras, borders, or religions. Instead, we seek out the tales of those who defied the odds and fought passionately for their beliefs. Whether they're right or wrong is up to you to decide. From Vercingetorix's doomed rebellion against Rome, to Osceola's unshakable war against the USA, all the way up to the inspiring Sobibor concentration camp uprising in World War II, each episode is an immersive listening experience, blending music and sound effects to really draw you into the story. Our episodes go for about 45 minutes, making them perfect for your commute, and are crafted using a wealth of historical sources, which I list on our website if you want to learn more. I'm the host, Elliot Gates, and I'm thrilled to have you joining me as we uncover history's hidden gems and illuminate the faded pages of our past. Look out for the Anthology of Heroes podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or anywhere else you get your podcasts from.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of the new Medal of Honor podcast from Evergreen Podcasts, brought to you in partnership with the National Medal of Honor Museum. In each 3-minute episode, we'll learn about a different service member who distinguished him or herself through an act of valor. We'll include stories from the Civil War to Iraq and Afghanistan, and from all branches of the military. We'll talk about service members who were overlooked for the medal at first due to their race or religion, and about those who were celebrated at the time. We'll hear stories of soldiers like Audie Murphy, future Hollywood star who mounted a burning tank to hold off German infantry in World War II, and people like Dr. Mary Edwards Walker, a Civil War Army doctor and the only woman to receive the Medal of Honor so far. Learn about these heroes and more wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
We want to tell you guys a little bit about our podcast. Tom and I met in college, became best friends, and then teachers almost 20 years ago. Sometimes school just does not allow us to elaborate on the topics that we find interesting, like the real shark attacks that inspired the movie Jaws, or the real historical context to Indiana Jones artifacts. Where does cereal come from? Or are zombies real? Does Ben Franklin really deserve to be on a $100 bill? On our podcast, just like in our class, there are no stupid questions.
Just two friends having a lighthearted conversation about history, pop culture, and the context of current events.
Listen to History Teachers Talking Podcast from Evergreen Network, anywhere you get your podcasts.